There were many of you who weren't there last night and that night, so I thought it might be a good idea to tell you something that you about the faith that you don't ordinarily read about as you read the writings. And this will go back over quite a number of years. Actually, it'll go back to around 1910, so that's a long while. And the stories that I'll tell you are as clear in my mind today almost as the time they happened. And I think it's very interesting to see the environment from which many of us come and how we come into the faith. And so I'm going to be personal on a lot of these stories, and you'll just disregard the personal element because you can't tell the stories without being personal. Fatimer, maybe somebody in the room remember her. They were early Baha'is in Portland, Oregon. And my mother and Mrs. Latimer were members of the Browning Society on the Pacific Coast. My mother was president of that organization. And Mrs. Latimer knew something about the Baha'i faith, but in 1910, it was very sparse, very little that they knew. They had typewritten excerpts from the writings. As a matter of fact, they didn't know who Abdu'l Baha was. They were used to refer to him as a great Persian philosopher. This is the term they used, and they referred to the Baha'i faith as a movement, a world movement. But she would tell my mother about the Baha'i faith and her movement, and mother would bring this material home to our house to try it out on the family. And I remember listening to her talk about it, but I'd say, well, you know, mother, I'm not interested in religion anymore, and this material would usually go on the bookshelf or whatever we'd have. We had the hidden words at that time, but the excerpts and writings were usually typewritten by friends in the East, and they'd pass them all over the country that way. So I paid no attention to it. But one day my mother announced that there was a man from New York City, Roy C. Wilhelm. He was a coffee merchant, and he was coming to, we were living in Tacoma at that time, and she was going to have him speak on the Baha'i movement. She wanted to know if I wouldn't come and listen to him, and I told her, no, mother. I says, you know, I'm not interested in the subject of religion. I'd rather work in my shop. Well, knowing my mother wasn't the kind of a person to take that kind of an answer, I went down in my shop all right in the basement of the house, but I heard her talking to Mr. Wilhelm in the kitchen to go down in the basement and tell me about the Baha'i movement. Well, there was only one way out of our basement, so I knew I had to wait and take this when he came down. Well, Roy came down the stairs, and I was prepared to fence with him on talking about the Baha'i movement, and he never even said a word about it. He came over and he asked me about the lathe that I had there and a band saw and some other things. He got interested in the work that I was doing, and we struck up quite a friendship. As I looked him over, I said, well, this fellow seems to be quite a guy. He isn't all cracked up on the subject of religion. Well, the result was I was quite friendly with him, and I would have been anyway, but I was quite friendly with him because I felt here's a man that isn't tied up in these things. And while we were talking down there, he says, you know, I'd like to have a shop like this in my home in New York. And if you ever come to New York, I'd like to have you come and help me set one up. Well, I said, Roy, you know, that's a long way out. I don't see any chance of my ever going to New York. Well, he says, you never know about those things. Well, I says, well, if I come to New York, I'll certainly be glad to see you. And he left. Well, about a month after that, things changed in my father's affair. He was a civil engineer, and he went to New York to set up a business for a firm there in Seattle. And I had been working for Ford Motor Company on the Pacific Coast, and I transferred that next 2 months to Detroit, Michigan. You know, when they were paying the $5 a day, which was quite a fare in those times, and you had to account for a half of that $5 to the Ford Motor Company. You had to spend it on things worthwhile, furniture, clothing, things of that kind. If you didn't do it, why, the welfare worker came around, took $2.50 away from your $5. Well, while I was in Detroit at that time, I felt some need of going somewhere to some religious group, and I joined the Unitarian Church for a short period, more for a social background than anything else. And one Sunday morning, the minister announced that there was a man there, Persian, was present, who was going to talk to us on the Baha'i movement. Well, my ears picked up because here was this movement again. And he says, anyone who would like to stay after the service and listen to him is welcome to stay. Well, the church cleared out, and I was one, and another man. There were two of us stayed here, and this was Dr. Zia Baghdadi. Well, you perhaps heard him. Well, Dr. Baghdadi, if any of you have heard read stories about him and know anything about him, know he was a very ardent Baha'i, He didn't bother him that there were only two of us. He got up on the platform. Even the minister excused himself. He had another appointment and couldn't stay. Well, Dr. Baghdadi got up on the platform and he talked to two of us about the Baha'i faith. I don't remember to this day what he was said. I was so intrigued that here was somebody talking about the Baha'i movement. And this passed off. And then about a week after that, I got a letter from my father who was in New York, and he wanted to know if I wouldn't come east to spend the Christmas holidays with him. And I made arrangements to go east. And I just made the arrangement when the foreman was working under there came to me. He says, well, Kelsey, he says, you'll have to give up your vacation this year. Well, I said, Mr. Pulaski, I'm sorry, but I've made arrangements to go east, and I can't give it up. Well, he says, you'll have to give it up. And I says, well, I'm sorry, I can't give it up. I made these arrangements. Well, he says, you won't get $5 outside the Ford Motor Company. I says, well, that settles it. Now I'm not only going east, but you can give me my time. And he says, oh, no, you can't do that, because in those days you had to explain, if you quit Ford Motor Company, you had to go before the welfare board of Ford Motor Company, explain why you were leaving such a good job. And it took me 5 hours to get out of Ford Motor Company that time. Well, I went on in New York. And of course, I got a better job when I landed in New York and worked with my father. And I worked for him for a number of years after that. Well, I hadn't been home more than 2 or 3 weeks, and I came down with typhoid fever. And you see, didn't know anything about the faith then, except that I remembered the name, and I was intrigued by the name. And with this typhoid fever, you have a terrific headache that accompanies it. And we were living in Van Cortlandt Park in New York at the time, and I remember my mother had made me very comfortable trying to relieve this severe headache that I had. She put ice packs on my head, and she'd gone to bed, and the family had gone to bed. But this pain was so terrific that I was turned over and trying to push my head in the pillow to relieve the pressure on my head. And as I did so, I heard a full-piece orchestra in the room. All the instruments. Of course, there wasn't any physical instruments there, but I heard it as if there was a beautiful orchestra there. And I swung around in bed to see what this was, because I never had anything like that happen to me. And as if it floated away, and I started to follow it, listening to it, you know. And this so surprised me, I called out to my mother, and she came running into the room thinking something seriously had happened to me, and she found me sitting up in bed, and I told her what had happened. And the first thing she did was go and get some Baha'i books to find out what this was. Well, she sat up with me the rest of the night, and I was reading these books and looking them over, and one after another, answered questions, and the hidden words, and seven valleys, and a few things like that. As I began to read these things, I says, why haven't you told me about this before? She says, I've been trying to tell you this for 9 years, but you wouldn't pay attention to it. Well, this experience so intrigued me that I camped on every Baha'i's doorstep that I could find, and I gave up my work. My father says, what's the matter? He says, can't you be satisfied with a little reading? No, I says, Dad, I've got to get around and find out what this is about. So I camped everywhere, and the Baha'is came in those 2 or 3 weeks I was sick there with the typhoid fever. Even the doctor came in the next morning, and he found me sitting up. He couldn't understand it. When the friends came in, they tried to answer, and they couldn't give me any information about this experience. Well, I went on everywhere to try to find my interest, was trying to find the reason for this experience, but at the same time, by doing so, I was absorbing the Baha'i writings. Well, then the war came along. And, of course, 1918, I had to go into that, and I had an extra gas mask I took along with me. I had the books with me, Baha'i books with me. And you know what a reception you get when you try to give a bunch of soldiers a Baha'i message. But one young man I gave the message to was quite interested, and I'd only had a chance to talk with him about a week and different things, and give him as little as I knew, which was very little at that time. And our lives separated, and I went on over through the First World War, and after the war I was in Paris and sitting in a restaurant, and I happened to look up, and this fellow I'd given the message to was sitting across the restaurant, and we both got up, met in the center of the restaurant, and the first thing he says, I want to know more about the Baha'i movement. He became a Baha'i. Well, then I came back to America, and I was down Wall Street visiting with my friend Mr. Wilhelm, who was a coffee merchant. He was known in the coffee market as the Tiffany of the coffee trade. He made these blends for Beechnut and other of the leading coffee brands that you know of on the market. And he had his office down the foot of Wall Street. And Roy, when I was down there, he said, you never know about these things. Here we were in New York. And I had gone out to his place to work on a shop, and we had got a shop started. And one day we were talking at noon there at lunch together, and he says, how would you like to go to Haifa? And I said, Roy, I'd like nothing better, but that's impossible. Well, again, he said, you never know about those things. I began to see there's some twist to this. Well, he had written, Roy had was a type of a Baha'i that had come into the cause through an inner experience also, a very dramatic experience that he'd had. And he was a very wonderful believer. He was a hand of the faith, as you know, if you've known about him. And anything that Abdul Baha would ask him to do, he'd do, no matter what Abdul Baha would ask him. So Roy had read a tablet of Abdul Baha's where Abdul Baha was speaking about the Bab, who was in prison in the fortress of Shariq, and where he didn't even have a candlelight. If you've read that tablet where he speaks about the Bab, didn't even have a candlelight, where it says, all the world is illumined with light, and the one they're looking for is in prison who doesn't even have a candlelight. This so impressed Roy that he wrote to Abdul Baha and wanted to know if he couldn't send a lighting plant over there to light the shrine of the Bab. And Abdul Baha wrote back and says, yes, you can send three. Well, Roy was the kind of a fellow who would send three, so he right away he sent the three. Well, when he was talking about my going to Haifa, he had some plan in back to have me go over. So when I told him I'd like nothing better, he wrote to Abdul Baha, and shortly after he wrote to Abdul Baha, I got a cablegram from the master, in which all it said Curtis Kelsey permitted. But with that cablegram, I got the strongest impression that I must make every effort to go to Haifa as quickly as possible, and to get there within at least 30 days. This is the impression I got. Well, I did, like all young men, I didn't have any money to mount anything. You spend what you earn, you know. And I had an old Model T Ford, and we were living in New Rochelle at that time. And I drove down to one of the grocery stores around 6 o'clock at night, where I knew several of the fellows, and I blew in at this busy hour, and I said out, who'd like to buy my Ford? Well, they looked with this blank look and don't answer right away. And I felt kind of sheepish, and I started to walk out. And one of the boys came running, wait a minute, Kurt. He says, if that'll climb a certain hill here, I'll give you $150 for it. And I had just cleaned the spark plugs that day, so we went over the hill in high, and I got my first $150. Then I sold a few other things, and I think I'd gotten about $250, $300 together, and I went downtown shortly after that talking to Roy. He says, how are you making out on this trip? And I said, I'm making out pretty well, but not enough. He says, well, I'm going to give you $500 more. So he gave me $500. And that was then I said, well, now I've got to act on this. So I thought I'd better go and tell my father, because he wasn't a Baha'i, and he had no idea of what the Baha'i faith was. And when I told him, he was dead against my going halfway around the world that time, but he wasn't the kind of man would oppose me. He just said how foolish it was to go halfway around the world. And he says, you're going to do this work for this little old man, Abdul Baha, over there, and he aren't even going to pay you for it? Well, I said, Dad, I can't explain to you, but I simply have to go, and all I want is your permission. Well, he said, you can go, but he says, don't expect any help from me. He says, I think it's a foolish move. Here you are just getting started, and you're going halfway around the world. Well, I was satisfied, I said, and I started out to buy my ticket, and I went down to find out how quickly I could get there, and I tried to go to Paris and to Naples and to Alexandria, and then we went down by the railroad around Mount Carmel, and I said I had to get there in about 30 days, and they said, no, it's impossible. You can't do that in that time, at least 3 weeks before you can get a boat out of Naples. Well, I said, you give me a ticket that way anyway. I'm going on that way. So they gave me the ticket, and I went on to Paris. But before I left, down at the boat were a number of the friends with messages to take to Abdul Baha, and my father was in the audience, and he came over where I was, and he'd bought me a Graflex camera and some film. And then he gave me an envelope, and he says, you open this when you get on the boat. And when I got on the boat and opened this, there was another $250 in it. So he wasn't going to do anything, but he did. Well, then we got on the boat, and I landed in Paris, and I immediately tried to find out if I could get a sailing out of Naples, and they said, no, there's no sailing out of there for at least 2 or 3 weeks. Well, I said, I'm going on down there. And he says, why don't you stay up here in Paris? There's a lot more fun here in Paris than down Naples. I said, no, thanks. I'm going on down to Naples. So I went down to Naples, and I made inquiry for a sailing out of Naples, and they told me there was nothing out of there. So I said to the steamship man, and I said, well, I'll be down to see you tomorrow. He says, no, don't do that. He says, we know our business, and there's nothing out of here. He says, where are you staying? And I said, I'm staying in such and such a hotel. He said, I'll call you up if something happens, but it won't happen. And that satisfied me. He'd call me up. So I went back to the hotel. While I was having dinner that night, they came in and said there was a phone call for me. And I went to the phone, and this was the steamship office. He says, how did you know the Asperia was going to dock here? I said, I didn't know. He says, well, they stopped here to let a sick passenger off. And if you want his passenger, I says, I'll take it. And the next morning, I was on my way to Alexandria. And between Naples and Alexandria, I met Charles Dane, the head of the American missionary work in Europe. And he sought me out because he wondered who this young man was going to the Near East. And I told him about the Baha'i Faith. He said, well, I know quite a number of the students at the University of Beirut are very fine young men. And he says, one of the things that puzzles me is how the Baha'i students are able to convince so many Mohammedans of the Christian faith. Well, I says, I forget your name. I hope I mentioned it.
Dana.
Yeah, Dana. And I said, that's very simple. The answer there is that the Baha'is don't tear down the life of Muhammad. Well, he thought for a minute, and he nodded. I said, they accept Muhammad the same as they accept Jesus Christ. And he said, do you mind if I go along with you all the way? I'd like to see this shrine on Mount Carmel. I passed there, but I've never gone up. And I said, no. So he went with me all the way and went up to see the shrine, and then he went on to Beirut. Well, in those days, we came in a train, and down the train was Abdu'l-Bahá's high buckboard wagon. There are four seats in the wagon. You may have seen pictures of it. And there was Fujita. You've heard of Fujita, the Japanese young man at that time. He's in my age now. And Dr. Lotfula Hakim, who's the treasurer of the International Council, was. And you've heard stories about him. Well, they were down there to meet me at the train. And then we drove up from the station down to the Western Pilgrim House. And Mrs. Graven, Enos Graven, was there. Her name was Cook. You perhaps heard of her in La Jolla, California. She was there with a sister, and Madam Standard from India was there. And we had just passed the time of day when the door opened from the room, and out came through the door Abdu'l-Bahá in his long, flowing camel's hair robe and a white turban and a white beard. And there are no words to describe the majesty of this personage that came through the door. As I looked on him, and as he came through the door, and he walked over to the head of the table and seated people, and he didn't say a word to me. But when he sat down, and I was sitting on this side of the table, he looked over to me and he said, did you notice how easy it was for you to come here? In English. And I had reached there within the 30-day period. Well, then, after dinner, he bade us all goodbye, and he said, well, we will see you at supper tonight. And for many days after that, there were no pilgrims, and every day at noon and while I was in Haifa, the master would come over at the table for dinner, and there'd be just Castro and Rui Afnan and myself at the dinner table. Abdu'l-Bahá would bring his mail and newspapers, and Abdu'l-Bahá had a brown cat, and Fujita and I would hide the cat when the master would come in the room, and when the master would come over the door, he'd say, let the cat out. And the cat would run over and rub up against the master's feet as he pet it. And Abdu'l-Bahá would sit down at the dinner table there these days, and he'd push his turban back on his head. And it was such a wholesome, in the full meaning of the word, simplicity, you know, of Abdu'l-Bahá, as a great person as he was, would read his mail daily there, and he would talk to us about the faith at these times. And he would talk many times in Arabic or Persian to the boys, and many times he'd speak to me in English. Well, then, for 15 days, he didn't let me go to work at anything. I came over there to set up these plants, these three light plants, to wire the shrine of Baha'u'llah and of Abdu'l-Bahá, the Bab on Mount Carmel, and the home of Abdu'l-Bahá. Well, I busied myself trying to get everything ready. I got all the parts laid out in catalogs so I knew where to work. And someone had sent Abdu'l-Bahá a Cunningham car that was in a garage that didn't know how to operate it, and a Ford car that was in a garage knew how to operate it. So I busied myself and got those in shape. Was driving those around the streets. In those days, if you went around the corner of one of the streets in Haifa, you had to back up twice to turn a corner. And I got those ready. And about after 15 days, I was getting worried I wasn't starting on these light plants, and I knew it was going to take me a long time to get busy, but I didn't dare ask Abdu'l-Bahá because I knew he knew. So I was standing out in front of Abdu'l-Bahá's home. If you've seen pictures of the street in front of Abdu'l-Bahá's house, there's a big stone gate, and you look through that gate to the porch. It's about 150 feet to the porch. And we were in the middle of the street looking through this stone gate, and I was talking to his grandson. And I said, Rui, when do you think Abdu'l-Bahá is going to let me start on this work? I've got to get started if I ever go home. Well, he said, Kurt, I don't know when he's going to let you start. And Rui hadn't any sooner made that statement, I don't know when you're going to start, than Abdu'l-Bahá came out the door on his porch, and he called to us. He said, we will start tomorrow. And he smiled and went back in the house. Well, I was delighted to think we were going to get started tomorrow. And we had a room, a bedroom in the Western Pilgrim House. It was about the size of this square. And Dr. Latfula had a bed there in Fujita, and I had a bed in this corner, and our door was in this corner. And before we could get out of bed the next morning, the master stood in the door. And we all rushed to get up quick, because it was about 5:30 in the morning. And he said, no rest. And then he said to me, he says, I can't go to ACCA today. What shall I do about it? Well, a thought flashed in my mind, and I repeated to the master. I says, well, whenever the master's ready, I'm ready. Now, he said we couldn't go. Well, that afternoon, he sent word over we were going to ACCA to make arrangements for lighting the shrine of Baha'u'llah. So at 4 o'clock, Rui Afnan and Khosrow and Abdu'l-Baha and I went down to the railroad station in Haifa. And that time, the only way you went to Haifa was once a day, the night train from Haifa to ACCA, a narrow-gauge Turkish railroad, or you drove in his high buckboard wagon by the way of the sea along the seashore. Well, we were taking the train, the narrow-gauge Turkish railroad, and everything was on that train, chickens and goats and everything else that went along. And these people were going this one trip over at night to go into the city of ACCA. And the train stopped about a quarter of a mile outside the city. ACCA's a walled city. And if you didn't get in there at 6 o'clock when the sun went down, you stayed outside the city at night. Well, we weren't going to ACCA that night. We were going 2.5 miles inland to Baji, where the shrine of Baha'u'llah was. Well, we went down to the station at Haifa to start, and Abdu'l-Baha didn't get on the train. He sat down at the railroad station, and the conductor was quite concerned because he wanted the people on the train, and he knew that he must have had this experience a number of times with Abdu'l-Baha because he didn't start the train, but he took a look at his watch, and he looked over at the station, and he didn't go and say anything to Abdu'l-Baha. But Abdu'l-Baha just sat there, and pretty soon I saw this Arab come leading a camel. And he walked into the station and sat down, and Abdu'l-Baha started to talk with him and laughed together. And a few minutes, and after he finished talking, then Abdu'l-Baha got up and got on the train, and we were on our way. And we landed at ACCA, and it was a most wonderful evening. It was one of those evenings when there was a full moon and white clouds drifting by in this full moon, you know, just a really spring evening. And the train stopped, and all the people got out and went into ACCA, and Abdu'l-Baha sat down in the station. And Rui Afnan and I stood outside waiting, and Abdu'l-Baha didn't get up. He just sat there, and pretty soon, coming through the desert, was this big Arab with the headdress, black headdress, and cape hanging down over his shoulders. And he was walking alone and through the sand, and he came into the station, and he and Abdu'l-Baha had a conversation, laughing together and talking. And while they were talking, I saw Khalid coming leading Abdu'l-Baha's white donkey. He'd come from Baji. And when they got there at the station, Abdu'l-Baha got up and got on the white donkey, and Rui Afnan and I walked alongside the donkey as they rode from the railroad station to Baji, about 2.5 miles. And Abdu'l-Baha pulled his Abdu'l-Baha up over him, and he said, beautiful night, wonderful sky, beautiful moon. And he says, are you finding it difficult to walk? And of course, I wasn't even thinking about walking. I was walking alongside of him. Well, we reached Baji, and I don't remember, the time was so short, it was such a wonderful thing to be walking alongside of Abdu'l-Baha. And at that time, the Baji was not in the possession of the Baha'is. So we went down to a little house on the corner of the garden. We had to go up a flight of steps, you've seen them perhaps, and then in this inner court, which is a room a little bit bigger than this, and off of the room was a garden with an orange tree in it, and in the kitchen where they cooked things on a charcoal stove. And Khosrow had run on ahead and prepared the dinner for us. We had curried lamb in rice and saffron on it, and candied orange peel, and there was Persian melons and bowls of must, which is like our yogurt, with the greens, chopped up greens in it, and large bunches of grapes from Damascus on the table. The master was talking about these wonderful grapes. They were so tender that the skin, you didn't notice it when you ate them. He said, you don't get grapes like this anywhere else. And while we were talking about the grapes, someone rattled across the door, and there was a big crossbar across the door, and Abdu'l-Baha says, Bismillah, be for me, come in the name of God. And someone rattled the door, and Khosrow ran over and removed the crossbar, and here stood an Arab about 6'4". He stood there just grinning, didn't cross the threshold, and Abdu'l-Baha repeated, Bismillah, be for me. And he came in, and Abdu'l-Baha sat him down at the table, the right side of the table. And they began a conversation in Arabic, which I didn't know anything about. And Rui, of course, knew all about it and was listening. And they were laughing, and all of them were laughing at this conversation. I was very intrigued to know what was going on. And then Rui, afterwards, told me what the conversation was, and this is what was going on. It seemed that somebody had been stealing Abdu'l-Baha's sweet oranges. So Abdu'l-Baha had said to this Arab, He said, isn't there a tradition among the Arabs? He belonged to a nomad tribe that they pitched their tents anywhere. He says, isn't there a tradition among the Arabs that if the father hasn't stolen something, his wife won't let him come in the tent at night? He says, yes, that's true. And Adhoa says, well, have you ever been kept out of the tent? He said, no, he'd never been kept out of the tent. So Adhoa says, had he ever tasted sour oranges? And the man said, no, he'd never bothered with sour oranges. Well, Adhoa says, they're very good with sugar on. And the next day, he began to steal Adhoa's sour oranges. Well, the next morning we went into the shrine with Abdu'l-Baha of Baha'u'llah, and I can see him today. We were standing at the threshold of Baha'u'llah's shrine, and Abdu'l-Baha was chanting the tablet of visitation, and I stood behind him about four paces while he chanted this wonderful tablet of visitation. And then Abdu'l-Baha said to Rui Afnan, he wanted the rugs and things in the shrine taken up and taken into Akka. Well, we didn't know why he was doing this, but we took up all the precious things that were in the shrine of Baha'u'llah, and then we drove on to Akka, and that evening for supper we stayed in the house of Abud, where Baha'u'llah revealed the Akdas, the Book of Laws. And that evening at supper, the chiefs of the Druids came in with two of his sons. The chief was 92, brought two of his sons in. They were a very clean tribe of people in the Lebanon Mountains. You can distinguish the Druids by their cleanliness. But the father, all during the table, the meal, was crying while Adhoa was talking to him, and he was Adhoa was trying to comfort him. And I later learned that this father sensed that this was the last time he'd see Abdu'l-Baha. They looked upon Abdu'l-Baha as one of them. They felt that Abdu'l-Baha had fulfilled the prophecies for them, too. Well, dinner was over, and Abdu'l-Baha embraced him and bid them goodbye. And we got in this, instead of going back on the train, we rode back in this high buckboard wagon along the way of the sea, Mediterranean Sea. And we were about halfway back from between Haifa and Akka, Akka and Haifa. There was a beautiful sunset over Mount Carmel. I asked the master if I could stop and take a photograph, and he said yes, and we stopped the car, and I got one of the most wonderful shots of the sunset coming over Mount Carmel at the time. And then we drove back to Haifa, and then Adhoa had told me he wanted me to work 2 weeks on Mount Carmel and 2 weeks in Badi so that I'd bring the lighting of the shrines up at the same time so that they'd be finished so that they could turn the lights on in both shrines at the same time. Which meant I'd spend 2 weeks in Akka and then go back to 2 weeks to Haifa and work. Well, during that time, this was in November, one night we were in bed. This is the middle of the night. Someone banged on our door in the Western Pilgrim House and said, get up, the master. And of course, Pujita and Dr. Lathul and I, we were so surprised. We were out of our room in no time flat and went over to the master's house to find out. And I walked in the room, the master's room, and Dr. Florian Krug was just closing the master's eyes. He had just passed away. And you've read stories about the few minutes before he passed away, the daughter spoke to him and asked him if he wanted something to drink. And he said, you would ask me to drink when I'm passing? The master knew he was going. It was just as if he laid his coat aside and passed away that quickly. And, of course, pandemonium broke loose when the master passed. The people, if you've ever seen the Mohammedans and some of the Baha'is there wailing at the thing of that kind, there was just chaos around the home. And I didn't seem to be affected by this. I loved the master very much, but it didn't affect me emotionally. And I thought there was something personally wrong with me, and I was trying to affect this emotion. And while I was trying to think, well, I should affect this emotion, I got the thought came to me, no, this is the time to observe. So I looked around and what was going on to see everything was there, and here was the greatest holy leaf, the sister of the master, and she was going around to this one and the other one. She took command of me. We were all crying too at this thing, and of course we went along this sandbar. I followed Castro, and we got by all right. We got the next one, we got by the next sandbar, and we drove on to Akka, and we informed the friends, Bahia Khanum had told me to come back as quickly as possible. So we turned right around and started back, and we could see our tracks in the sand, so we didn't think it was necessary to find the sandbar. So I got over the first one all right, but when we came to the next one, the water had moved the sandbar, and the ford went down into the water above the floorboards and stalled the motor right, and here we were out in the bay. And Fujita and Nora and Castro and I all jumped out to save the Ford because it was just gradually settling down the sand. We walk around the car and lift one wheel up, and when they would lift, when bend over, their feet would slide out and they'd float in the water. Well, I said, this can't keep this up all night. So I sent Castro, who was very quick and running, to find some fishermen, some Arab fishermen to come. And then Fujita and I kept going around. We were going around for a couple of hours, keeping the Ford from sinking. And this is early in the morning. And I knew these Arabs that were fishing and throwing their nets out, and they were very husky men. And I could see them way down the coastline there fishing, and Casa ran down to get them. As they came trotting back, you could hear their jabbering. 10 or 12 of them come running on the trot back along the seashore. And they ran out in the water, and they picked that Ford up bodily and carried it right on shore. And we cleaned the water out of the carburetor and drove back to Haifa. And when we got to Haifa, there were thousands of people gathered around the master's house there that knew about this. They came in from the village for miles around. There were more than 10, 20, or 12,000 people around the city of Haifa at the time. And they had sent news to the High Commissioner in Jerusalem about the passing. He sent word he would be there. And that morning, finally he came. You've seen pictures of the funeral in the old Stars of the West. You'll see these sets of pictures that were taken. And as soon as the British High Commissioner came there and the judges and other high officials of Akka come in to pay their respect, Abdu'l-Bahá's coffin moved out the door on the shoulders of the friends down the stairs just as if it floated on the air. And no group of people carried that coffin more than 10 paces. They take it away from each other. That's the way they carried it, all the way down the steps and up Mount Carmel Avenue, up Mount Carmel. And these were non-Baha'is that were carrying the Master's tablet. They took it away from the Baha'is. When it got up the corner, the Boy Scouts placed a Persian shawl on the casket. And a little further along, the Boy Scouts placed a wreath on it. And finally, they carried the coffin up Mount Carmel, and they set it out on the table there. And there's where they gave those 9 addresses about Abdu'l-Bahá. There was a Frenchman, I remember. He was giving the eulogy about Abdu'l-Bahá, and he says, "Don't weep for Abdu'l-Bahá. Weep for those who he has left here." You remember, if you read those 9 addresses, you'll see how wonderful they were. And he was so enthusiastic in talking about Abdu'l-Bahá that he started to fall off of the step, the stump. He was standing on the stump speaking. And they reached over and grabbed him and set him right back on the stump. Well, then, of course, this passing of the master was a terrific experience to the friends. No one knew what was going to happen to the cause in those days. We had no idea of how the cause was going to continue. And there were long days. Shoghi Effendi was in London. And we knew there was a will left by Abdu'l-Bahá, and no one knew what was in it. And so they were waiting for Shoghi Effendi to come back. And Shoghi Effendi arrived, it was about a month before he arrived, and when he arrived, they read this will. The Baha'is took about it all day reading the will and testament of the master, and Shoghi Effendi, of course, was appointed the guardian in that will. And this was a terrific shock to him. And he was ill for a couple of days, and then he left Haifa for two or three weeks after that, and the cause was in the hands of the greatest Holy Leaf, as you remember, you read that. She administered the faith for that period that the guardian was away. Well, then these stories that Abdu'l-Bahá had told through the days, we could see that he had told us about his passing, but none of us recognized it at the time. There was a caretaker of the Shrine of the Bab on Mount Carmel, who was a big, husky man, and Abdu'l-Bahá had gone to him a couple of days before passing. He said, "I wish you could carry me away to a place where I could rest." Well, to the gardener on top of the hill, he had revealed the secret to him that he was going to pass, and he hadn't told anybody. But this man had been told where to open the floor of the shrine for the body of Abdu'l-Bahá to be placed in the lower part of the shrine. So he had opened the floor at that time, and I took a picture of this particular place. But when they lowered the coffin of Abdu'l-Bahá down through this opening in the floor, it was this man that Abdu'l-Bahá had told him to carry him away to a place where he rests. He was so strong, he bore the whole weight of that coffin as it was carried down through the floor, some 30 or 40 feet below the floor. So it's right in the direct center of the shrine on Mount Carmel now is where Abdu'l-Bahá is buried. And in the back 3 rooms in the center is where the body of the mob is. Remains are buried. Then, of course, you may not have read this story, but I'll just tell you about it. The gardener who was taking care of Abdu'l-Bahá's gardener was a very wonderful man. He saw Abdu'l-Bahá every day, and he just couldn't stand Abdul Hawes passing, and he went out up on Mount Carmel, and he went behind the shrine of the Bab, and he cut his throat from ear to ear. And he wanted to be sure he'd die, so he took his red turban and catched the blood as he was bleeding to be sure he'd die. Well, Rui Afnan came running down to the Western Pilgrim House at Dr. Kruganine, and he told us about it, and we jumped in the Ford, and I drove up Mount Carmel to bike the fine. We found him there, and Dr. Krug raised his head back then, and he was saying the greatest name. Dr. Krug, this man will never live. We got him down to English Hospital. The man recovered, and he went back to work, and he served the Guardian for many months after that. He lived. Now, the sequel to this is that many nights before that, Abdul had been talking to us, and one of these nights, whereas it was custom to talk to us every night about 7 o'clock, he had talked on suicide. And he said no one should ever take their life because God never gave anyone a burden greater than they could bear. And this man was present who had taken his life, you know, cut his throat, and he didn't get away with it because he was healed and he went back to serve the Guardian and passed away normally as working for the Guardian. There were so many other stuff. I'm trying to think of some of the stories that came there. Well, teachings say that if we could actually see the next world, there's nothing could keep us here. Mm-hmm. That God veils us from the next the step ahead of us so that we'll fulfill the obligations and the job that we have here. And, of course, if one takes that step ahead of time, of course, the consequences of that step, there's results that would happen if one took that step ahead of time. Because you would interfere with your destiny while you're living here. Now, I'm trying to think of some of the other things. There's so many things happened there. Oh, we were up at the... every night at 7 o'clock, the men would meet in Abdul Hall, one of the rooms in Abdul Hall's house, and we'd sit around the wall, and Abdul Hall would sit in the corner. And there might be 20 or more men there sitting, and they'd sit with their folded arms. They'd never speak to them unless Abdul Hall spoke to them. They were so happy to listen to him talk about the faith. And I used to sit on the wall opposite this corner, and this went on in Arabic or Persian, so I didn't understand much was being said, but I always enjoyed being present while these talks were going on. And one evening, Abdul Hall looked over and he said, "Do you understand what is being said here in English?" And I said, "No, Master, I don't." He says, "Well, your heart does, and the language of the heart is much more powerful than the language of words. But you can see that you sense when you talk to people. You don't have to say a word. If you're really compatible and there's a real affinity between people, words are not necessary all the time." Riding all that way back from Haifa with the master, he never said a word. But it was a wonderful experience just to be sitting alongside of him, riding back to Haifa. I was a young man at that time, and we used to go up at the shrine of the Bab and sit in the front room where he'd talk to us about the faith. Of course, this also was in Arabic, and there were a lot of things in the faith that I was questioning, not that I doubted them, but I couldn't understand them, and I would weigh these things in my mind. Well, I can't quite see this, you know. This is the conversation that was going on in my mind. And while I was doing this, thought flashed in my mind, "Look up." And I looked up, and Abdul Hall was in the corner, and he was looking directly at me, and he smiled, and he says, "Oh, I don't have any doubts." Like that. He'd caught my thought, and these things then. Of course, the master had passed away, and I went back and finished the work. And when I finished the lighting of the shrines, they were turned on at the same time. The one on Mount Carmel, I put a searchlight right on the shrine of the Bab that shone down Mount Carmel Avenue, and a searchlight on the shrine of Baha'u'llah, and the lights around the shrine. And you could see across these two lights. And they hadn't seen electric lights around there at that time. The children were so intrigued by this light, they'd play in the shadow of the searchlight on Mount Carmel Avenue and run up down the street. And it threw the ships off because the Catholic monastery on Point of Mount Carmel wasn't bright enough. So actually, the Shrine of the Bab became the lighthouse for the ships coming into the Bay of Haifa. And they had to turn that light on at sunset to sunrise every night as a guide for the ships coming into the Haifa. So actually, the Shrine of the Bab became a lighthouse for the ships coming into there. Well, one day, the greatest Holy Leaf had asked me at the passing of the Master if I'd take a picture of, I can understand why she did, wanted a picture of Abdul Hall when he lay in the bed after his passing. And I had this Graflex, and she'd call in the town photographer to take it, and he set up his camera, so I couldn't get it, so I had to hold it up over my head. And I got two very wonderful pictures of Adam Hall as he lay there, and he had a green turban on. They'd placed a green turban on him, because this green turban was a tradition among the Mohammedans that the Great One would wear this green turban. And these pictures turned out wonderfully, and the photographer who took a picture, while he was looking at his plate to see if it was good, it dropped out of his hand and broke in a number of pieces, so he couldn't use it. Well, I had the two negatives. Well, when Shoghi Effendi came back, he said he heard I had these pictures. He asked me to come over to see him. And I went over, and he told me about these pictures, and I said, do you want to see them? And he said, no, he'd prefer not to see them. And he said, he wished I would destroy them. So I said, all right, Shoghi Effendi, I'll be glad to destroy them, but can I take them back and show them to Mr. Wilhelm? He said, yes, you can do that, and let me know when they're destroyed. So I took him back to West Englewood, New Jersey with me to show him to Mr. Wilhelm, because I knew he'd be interested in all these things. And we looked at them, and then we burned them up together, and I wrote on the sheet that this was done. This filed in the archives there at the West Englewood Assembly, and a copy of this was sent to the Guardian. Then it came time for me to leave Haifa after about 8 months there, and I'll come back and tell you this story that comes to me, because I didn't tell this the other night. It's a very interesting one. Fujita, this young Japanese boy, had been an associate of the famous Japanese actor that came to this country, Soseya, I think his name was, in California. They were living together. Their fathers had sent from this country to go to school, and neither one of them were going to school. They were taking their money and having a high old time. And Fujita met Mrs. Goodall, Mrs. Cooper in California, and she gave him the message. Well, when she gave Fujita the message, Admiral Hall wrote him a tablet. And these tablets you can read there, where he speaks about, and he called attention to all the virtues that Fujita had, and told him that this knowledge that he had was much greater than ruling as the Mikado of Japan. And Fujita read this tablet, he tells me, he says, this isn't me, but the master was telling him it was him. He says, this is different, totally different than what I am. So he put the tablet aside. And about 2 months later, he got another tablet from Admiral Horn, and he did the same thing with it. And a third tablet came to Fujita about how wonderful he was and so forth. And Fujita says, well, he says, I better act on this because something will happen. So he didn't tell the fellows he was living with what he was going to do. He packed up his bag secretly and went back to school at Ann Arbor, Michigan to finish his schooling. And when Admiral Hall came to America, he sent for Fujita, and Fujita traveled across the country with him. And he told Fujita to study certain subjects in Ann Arbor, and one day he'd send for him to come to Haifa. So Fujita did this faithfully. After the war ended in 1914, he sent for, or was 1918, wasn't it? I forgot. Well, anyway, when the First World War ended, he sent for Fujita. And Fujita went to Haifa, and Admiral Hall put him in charge of the Western Pilgrim House as a servant. He waited on, cooked the breakfast for whoever was there, and every morning he'd have to go over and have tea with Admiral Hall early in the morning, which is a wonderful thing, and he was a little fellow. And Admiral Hall had him get the dress of a judge, which you would say was a mullah, which was this long white robe with a white turban, and told him to grow this beard, and this beard was what I call a moth-eaten beard, because there's a few hairs here and a few hairs there. And Admiral Hall used to laugh at Fujita and get a great deal of happiness in joking with him. And the people all over the city of Haifa loved Fujita. They knew he was closely associated with Admiral Hall. But Fujita was quite worried that here he had gone to college and prepared himself as Admiral Hall had told him, and Admiral Hall was having him do this work. So he had a whole trunk full of tuxedo and clothes of that kind. Every once in a while in the room, I'd see Fujita sit down in his trunk, and he'd open that trunk up and he'd look at all those clothes, all dressed up, nowhere to go. So one day I needed some special wire in wiring the shrine of the Baba Mount Carmel. I didn't want to put this black wire with, you know, the porcelain quilts, the old-fashioned wire on the inner shrine. So I asked Admiral Hall if he'd let me go to Cairo and pick out some lead wire that I could encase in the dome of the building there so it would all be concealed and switches. And Admiral Hall says, yes, you can take Fujita with him. He knew this would be something for Fujita, and so we were delighted we were going to Cairo, Egypt, to find this material. And Fujita and I started out, and he took his tuxedo with him. because he was gonna wear that tuxedo. Well, we got off the train in pitch dark there in Cairo. We didn't know where we were going to go. They hadn't told us where to go. We'd find some hotel. And we were talking, fugitive and I were talking at the railroad station in the dark air together. And Fudge says, I call him Fudge. I said, Fudge, where do you think? He says, I don't know. We'll walk uptown and find some hotel. And while we were talking, some woman came over close to us. She says, Alal Abha. I looked around, and this is Mrs. Norris of Washington, D.C. She had her two sons and her daughter with her. And she says, what are you boys doing here in Cairo? And I says, well, we've come here to buy some material for Abdul Hall. She says, well, where are you going? She said, well, we don't know. We're going up. You're going right with me, she said. So she took us to the Shepherd Hotel in Cairo, which is one of the main hotels there, a beautiful hotel. And she got us a room. I'd say it was twice the size of this room. And then it was two big beds, and the bed was this high off the floor. Well, if you could see Fujita when we opened the door to that bedroom. We were sleeping on beds at Haifa that just had a 3/4-inch mattress and boards and mosquito netting all around these iron beds. Fujita had been sleeping in those kind of beds for months. Well, when he looked, he was carrying the bags. As we went through the door of the room, he dropped the bags right in his track. He let out a war whoop and he took a nosedive right over the bed and landed in the middle of the bed and it fallen right up over him. And I stood looking at him, and here all I could see was this little head with a beard sticking out. And Mrs. Morris had told us to hurry up and come down to dinner. She was going to get ready to come down to dinner in the hotel. And so after Fudge looked around and enjoyed this nice soft feather bed, he got out of bed and he got dressed in his tuxedo, and we went down to this magnificent dining room in the Shepherd Hotel. And, of course, all eyes were on Fujita, who was this little Japanese with this smartly dressed tuxedo and so forth. And he ushered us into a central table in the dining room, and everybody was watching us. And pretty soon, in comes a man with, he was sort of an advance guard of some person, important person, with a very colorful uniform on. He came over to the table and asked for Fujita. And he said there was someone out there, some person friend, who wished to see Fujita. So Fujita got up and, you know, Japanese bowed very graciously to this man, and he walks out there with through there, everybody watching him through the door. And as he stepped through the door of the dining room, some person grabbed him and lifted him right up and kissed his beard. This man had known Abdul Hall had all pulled Fujita's beard, and then this person who knew Abdul Hall had done this, he just kissed this beard of Fujita. And then he put him down and talked to him, and Fujita wasn't at all embarrassed, and the people, of course, just intrigued the people more to see what was going on. Well, we finally had this visit over with meeting a number of people, and we went back to Haifa and arrived back there. And as I say, then the time came for me to leave to go home, and I'd spent all my money, except enough to buy deck passage from Constantinople to Constantinople. From Haifa to Constantinople was on the northern part of the Mediterranean, you know. As all young men, I felt that the world was my oyster. I could work to find my way to get back. I'd take a job in Constantinople and find enough money to get back home. And when I'd made up my mind to do this, I've got to come back and tell you about Fujita, too, because it's another interesting story. But I'll go on to finish this one first. So I made up my mind I'd go to Constantinople and I'd earn enough money to get home from there. Well, after I did that, the greatest holy sent word for me to come over to the house. That's the sister of Abdul Baha. And I went into the room, and here we were in the room where the master used to talk every evening. And the four daughters of the master and the greatest holy surrounded me, and I was right in the center. And they began to tell me how much the master would appreciate the work of lighting the shrines, and I was apologizing for I enjoyed it. I wasn't, you know, how you're doing those things. And finally, one of the daughters says, Kelsey, you need some money to return to America. And I said, oh, no, thank you. Everything's been taken care of. I don't need any money. And back of me, the other daughter says, Kelsey, you need some money to return to America. I turned around and I said, no, thanks. I don't need any money. It's all taken care of. And then the greatest holy says, Kelsey, you need some money to return to America. And I said no to her, too. Finally, she reached out and she took my hand. She says, Kelsey, you need some money to return to America. And you must take this money. And I said, well, I didn't dare tell the greatest holy if I couldn't take the money. So I said to her, well, I'll take it on one understanding if you let me return it when I get back home. She says, no. She says, this is the money for you to return to America. Mm-hmm. And then I had to take it. And what I had and what she gave me landed me back in New York City. And I hadn't told anybody about that. Then I'll come back and tell you this one of Fujita, when Fujita was so upset that he'd come over to Haifa and Abraham hadn't used him, his talents that he thought that wasn't used, he just figured out, no, I just made a dope of myself. I've come over here. He says, maybe I've been fooled about coming to Haifa. He says, I'm going to go back home to America. This is when Abraham was living there. And when he decided he was going to pack up and go back to America, Rui Afnan came over to the Western Pilgrim House, and he says, Fujita, Abdu'l-Hall wishes to see you. So Fujita trots over to Abdu'l-Hall's house, and he goes in the room, and Abdu'l-Hall says, Fujita, what's the matter? Well, he says, when you were in America, this is the way Fujita said, when you were in America, Abdu'l-Hall, you told me to study certain things, and when you need me, you'd send for me to come to Haifa, and I come over here, and all you're doing, let me take care of the Western Pilgrim House, and I can't do any of my work as you would. We're doing that. Abdu'l-Hall smiled at him. He says, well, he says, you see, if I wish mechanics or I wish this, I can get any of these people. But what you're doing is the work that Abdu'l-Hall wishes to do. Fujita says, that's perfectly all right with me. He says, even if I'm shining the master's shoes, that's perfectly satisfied. And he never made a... He went right back to it. He was very happy there. He went back to Japan for a while, and later Shoji Feni sent for him, and now he's in Haifa now. But I had to laugh where he was so concerned about going back to America. Well, those are some of the wonderful stories. There are many others I could tell you, but it'd take all night to keep on with it. I'll tell you about our beloved guardian, Shoghi Effendi. I had met him there in 1921, right after he became the guardian, and had several very nice visits with him. And then in 1953, I'll come up before that. In New York City, as I had become a very close friend of Mr. Wilhelm, Roy had been always doing things for Abdu'l-Hall. He was always doing the same things for the Guardian. And one day Roy said to me, he said, I want you to figure out the cost of a pump, because Ruhir Khanum and I were talking about bringing water to the shrine on Mount Carmel, the gardens around the Shrine of the Bab. I don't know anything about that. And he says, you work out the details. And he says, when you get this all worked out and the price of the pump, he says, when we hear from Shoghi Effendi, he says, you buy the equipment and I'll pay you for it. So I corresponded with an engineer in Tel Aviv and got the physical situation there, where the elevations were. Abdu'l-Hall had a well on his yard. It was 160 feet deep. That meant we had to lift water from this well some 300 feet up Mount Carmel to the gardens around the Shrine of the Bab. That's nearly 500 feet lifting of water. So I had worked out this plan and the kind of pump, a foolproof pump, that told that they wouldn't have any trouble with it, and worked this out and got everything ready, and we sat quiet. Well, in the meantime, Roy had contracted cancer and was dying with cancer. And a few days before he passed away, we received a cablegram from the Guardian. He did. This is North Level, Maine. Now, this was just conversation between Roy and I at the time about this pump. The Guardian knew nothing about it. We hadn't talked to the Guardian about it. I like to tell these stories because some people say Shoghi Effendi didn't know the same way the master did. So this cable came, and Roy was so sick. Hebe Struven, who was a sister of Lua Getzinger, she said Roy was so ill, she got down and whispered this cablegram into Roy's ear. That's how ill he was. And he said, Hebe, you tell Curtis about it. He knows just what to do. And the next day he passed away. Well, Hebe told me, he says, don't come up here, Curtis, for the money, because Roy made no provision to pay for that pump, and you better not buy it. Well, I says, Hebe, Roy told me to buy it, so I'm going to buy it. She says, well, don't come up here for the money, because there's no provision for it. I said, nevertheless, I'll go and buy the pump. And I remember my wife says, well, how are you going to pay for it? I says, I don't know, but I'll buy the pump. That'll take care of itself. So I ordered the pump, knowing I'd have 60, 90 days to pay for it, and I'd find some way to pay for it. And I sat quiet. And about 2 weeks after I bought that pump, Roy Ios, who was then treasurer of the National Spiritual Assembly, called me up from Chicago, and I had my office in the Woolworth Building that time. And he said, are you going to Haifa, Curtis? And I said, no, I'm not going to Haifa. He says, what makes you think I'm going to Haifa? He says, well, we got a very interesting cable from Shoghi Effendi. I said, what is it? Well, he says, he cabled us to send you $10,000. And then, what do you want us to do with it? And I says, well, if he said to send it to me, you'd better send it to me. So the next day, I got a certified check in the air mail for $10,000. And I didn't know what it was for. And so I opened up an account in the Irving Trust Company there in the name of the Guardian and the National Spiritual Assembly. If anything happened, they'd have the money. A couple of weeks went by, and I got a letter from the Guardian. And he said this money he had sent me would pay for the pump and other things that he was going to buy. And from that point on, he sent me about $50,000 to buy things, different times, which bought floodlights and wire and paint and everything that they did around the properties on Mount Carmel and at the Baji. Then one day I got a letter from the Guardian, and he said, take $600 and go and pay this man. He gave me his name. No address, just the name of the man. And I can remember today, I was talking to my secretary. She says, well, Curtis, how are you going to find this man? It's something like Smith, but it wasn't Smith. It was that kind of a name in the telephone book. So I says, well, we'll just go down the telephone book. And I went down the telephone book two or three times and says, I think I'll call this man up. And I called this man up, and I says, do you know His Eminence, Shoghi Effendi Rabbani? He says, yes. First man I had called. I said, well, I have a message for you from him. Could you come down to my office? And he said, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Kelty. He said, after I'd introduced myself, I can't come down. I can't explain to you over the phone. But I'd like to have you come up to my office. So I said, I'll do that. I got on the subway and went up to 6th Avenue and 46th Street. And there was the Diamond Market up there. I went up the fifth floor of this building. And I went into a little room, which is like a doctor's office was, because there was a lamp and a reading table and some magazines. And there was a door in the back wall with a peephole in it. And when I was in the room, this man opened the peephole, and he said, just a minute. I closed the peephole, and the door automatically opened, and I went in this room. And the door automatically closed behind me and locked. And as soon as the door locked, he stepped out from another door and introduced himself. And he pulled out a tray, and in it he had $250,000 worth of diamonds. And he says, this is the reason I couldn't come down to your office, because we transact our business here. And that's why it was behind locked doors. And I introduced himself, gave me some identification, and I gave him the $600, and I sent a letter to the Guardian, never heard another word from him. So when they tell you that the Guardian doesn't know, you can just remember that while at the station of Shoghi Effendi Rabbani, the Guardian of the Faith, this is a step down from Baha'u'llah to Abu Bahar to the Guardian, and the robe is with the Guardian just the same. And the distance is great, but the spirit and the power was there with the Guardian just the same. And I could tell you that Shoghi Effendi was such and such a height and things so forth. This wouldn't give you any concept of who Shoghi Effendi was. I can only say to you that when you're in the presence of Master or the Guardian, you were in your own home. You thought, this was your home. And such love went to anyone who sat in the presence of the Guardian that you couldn't but feel it, you know. One day he was talking to me. Oh, and then came 1953. And I'll close with this. I wrote to the guy and wanted to know if I could go to the Kampala conference. You know, he was asking us to take these international conferences, and he wrote back and says, postpone pilgrimage. And I hadn't been talking about a pilgrimage, but then a couple of weeks later, I got a letter from the guy, and he said he hadn't answered my letter right away because he felt I couldn't come. Well, if I had accepted the invitation to come on the road, I couldn't have come because something came up in my business. But then Mrs. Kelty and I went in 1953, and I was sitting across from the table from Shoghi Effendi, and I could see the same shoulders and the head of almost the personality of the Master as I looked at him. And he talked and acted in lots of ways, and he'd see and talk to you as if he's looking through the air and seeing what he was telling you about. He talked and described the International House of Justice and described the institutions. And you could see it in being as he talked, that how animated he was. You just hung on everything he said. Well, I went over there with the usual 9-day pilgrimage that people were supposed to go, thinking I'd be there for the 9 days. And the second day, Shoghi Effendi said, I'm going to extend your stay here. Last time you was here was to put in the lighting of the shrine. And this time it will be furnishing water for the gardens. And they had kept that pump over there till I got over there, and we set this pump up, running pipes around and building a little reservoir, carrying the water around the shrine gardens, the Baji, so forth. So that kept me there 26 days while the guy and I saw him for 12 nights straight. And he never once talked to me about any calamity. He talked about the institutions, the divine institutions. I wasn't interested in calamity. I was interested in the teaching. And he talked to me about the local spiritual assemblies, how they would evolve, and how the International House of Justice would come into being, how the institution of the guardianship would come into being, how there would be an international school on Mount Carmel. And he gave me permission to copy a drawing that he brought to the table that night of the World Center as it will develop on the side of Mount Carmel. There will be agencies is the first one is the International Archives, which we have up. Then there will be a building which will house the papers and material for the Station of the Guardianship. Then there will be a school for the higher scientists. And then he says these other two buildings he had drawn, the Baha'is will know about those later on. And it's just wonderful the way he talked to us about the faith. You could just see. One day he said to me, he said, when people say to you that these institutions, these Baha'is, and the institutions that humanity has had in the past are man-made. This is the first time in the history, as you know, of religion that we have institutions that are embodied in the revelation of Baha'u'llah. And he said there's a vast difference between a divine institution and a human institution. So I think, friends, these stories will bring you closer to the central figures of the faith and give you a glimpse of what a wonderful day we are have the bounty of living in. And we could never be thankful enough or grateful enough for having been brought to the consciousness of this revelation. The Master said that if we were to thank God 1,000 times with every breath, we couldn't be grateful enough for having been given this message in this dying. Well, I didn't tell you about that inner experience that I had. I was sitting at the table one night with the Master, and it came up, the conversation came up, and he told me this music I had heard back in New York was the music of the kingdom, and it had caused my spirit to become awakened. Now, you see, when you get away from religion, I wasn't even inventing. This is the thing that attracted my attention, and this is exactly what it did. It awakened my interest to the point where I understood what the faith was. And I can honestly say after some 50 years in contact with the faith that each day as you live grows happier and more joyful, and you look forward to the expanding of the faith and the glorious things that are ahead for all of us and for humanity. And Shoghi Effendi said, you tell the friends in America that nothing can happen to them or to the cause which isn't in its best interest, and that we should go ahead as if nothing was going to happen. So you can see that if we act with this enthusiasm for the cause and we stand on the two principles of firmness in the covenant and love for the friends, this thing will attract other people to our efforts, and we'll be confirmed in the service of the cause if we just keep those two facts in mind. Firmness in the teachings of the faith, which is the covenant of God, and love and fellowship among the friends. And our beloved guardian has said nothing else will attract the people than way this mirrors from us from our own inner life. We can't fool people by taking the name Baha'i. This is the day when it's impossible for a person to carry the name of religion without the action follows. You know, faith today, as the Master said, is conscious knowledge plus the action. It's impossible to have action with the faith that the action doesn't follow. So I'm very happy to be in your midst, and I want to say to you that the hands of the cause, Bill Sears and Mr. Cottam, advised me to be sure and extend their love and appreciation to you, and they're praying for your efforts, and they'll be happy, very happy to hear my report as I give them back a meeting with the friends. We had a meeting just recently with the hands of the faith in the Western Hemisphere and all auxiliary board members in the United States and Canada at the temple last 31st of December and January 1st. And we spent these 2 days in consultation on the urgency of the hour where we are now in to achieve the goals that remain in the next 14 months to establish these assemblies so that next year we'll have our 300 assemblies and all these goals. And Mr. Cottam explained to us the meaning of the word crusade, which was a very wonderful explanation we had. And he said the Guardian wasn't pleased with this word crusade, but it was the only English word that was the equivalent of the meaning that was in Arabic, which means jihad, which means holy war. But this, if we'd used the word holy war in the West, they'd misunderstood it. But what is meant by holy war is to strive with ourselves to overcome every deficiency in our life, to crusade with our own lives, so that we reflect the qualities, and as we crusade with our own selves to overcome all the deficiencies in our own lives, then we, by doing so, we will mirror forth these qualities which we're supposed to do as Baha'is in the image and likeness of God. The attributes, as you know, are the real image, and only when we are imbued with these attributes can we be this image. So it behooves every Baha'i to crusade every day, and by doing so, this is the real crusade, We remove the deficiencies in our life, and this becomes an attraction to other people. They see us in our happiness and joy of living and these things that they see from us and the kindness that emanates from us, this sort of thing. And we'll flee from anything that creates any inharmony in our consultation or any of these things. And this is the thing that the hands are urging us to do now in Haifa and the hands in the Western Hemisphere. But in our communities, if we could just get this ball started this way, it'll set the communities and everyone else on fire. We're on the verge of large groups of people coming into the faith, as you well know. So I'm very happy to be in your midst, and I've had a rushing week this week and the next one this week, and it's a really happy experience to meet other friends, and it's a joy being in your presence. For the Institution of the Guardianship, he never mentioned Guardian, the Institution of the Guardianship. You'll be interested in this. He told me, and I didn't see the reason for it, Mrs. Kelsey and myself, he was talking to, were at the table, and he spoke about the two causes that we have. One is the overall cause of God, he said, which we have nothing to do with. And then we have the divine plan, which we have everything to do with. And he says sometimes the overall plan of God intervenes in the divine plan. And then, you know, I didn't know at that time, get a picture of why he was saying this. But I understood why, what it was, but I didn't see why he was saying it. But then you remember shortly after 53, when the temple was to be built in Persia, this affair blew up in Persia, and they took the property away from the Baha'is and destroyed the national headquarters. And the Guardian at that time had to change his plan to have the temple in Persia and decide to have it in Kampala, you remember? The publicity attended with this persecution at the time, and going to Kampala caused the cause to rise in other parts of the world. This, he said, was an intervention. The Guardian called this an intervention. And then the removal of the Guardian was another intervention in the divine plan. Now, to a Baha'i, to a believer who understands the faith, you know that if God says black is white, it's white. I remember in 1912 when I was talking to Mr. Kinney, who was, he gave him the name Saffa, and this Saffa means Peter. He said to Saffa, he picked up a book and he says, Saffa, he says, this book is black, what do you say it is? And Mr. Kinney says, it's black. And the master says, Bali. Now, the master knew that wasn't a black book, but he was seeing Mr. Kinney, if he understood, instant and exact and complete obedience. Now, a Baha'i, as you read, you know that it says in the Egon that the acme of attainment for any believer is to admit to himself that God doeth whatsoever he willeth. And if we do not admit that to ourselves, we will be assailed by all kinds of doubts. And so to a man of faith, no argument is required, but to a man of doubt, no argument would ever satisfy him. So we must be prepared to know that God can change any situation. But this God, the cause of God is perfection itself. Nothing can interfere with the cause. So all we have to do is be patient that these things will work out. And when we have the International House of Justice, I saw numbers of tablets of Baha'u'llah that haven't even been translated yet. They will no doubt unfold many of the evolving phases of the faith. And we can just look forward to a glorious achievement in the faith. And when a person gets off to try to use this human mind to say, well, this is the way it should be then, and somebody has done this and upset this, This is human frailty. And if you read in the letters of the Guardian, it said human frailty is human action and frailty is powerless to damage the structure of the faith. So we already have the Institution of the Guardianship in 36 years of the most strenuous labors of the faith. Shoghi Effendi was mentioned in Isaiah. His name, Shoghi, means zeal. And it says in Isaiah, the zeal of the Lord shall accomplish this. But then we take the short view as Baha'is. We always think things going to be done in our life rather than really why we're dealing with somebody for 500,000 years. And the first part of the Baha'i faith is a dispensation of 1,000 years. So in this 1,000 years is a short period as far as the cause is concerned. And all the facets of the faith will work out. This is the faith the believer should have. And I'm sure you do have it. As I go around, since the passing of the Guardian, I find the cause is stronger. The enthusiasm of the friends is greater, and their efforts have increased 1,000-fold since the passing of the Guardian. As you know that, without my telling you. You can see people coming in large numbers everywhere. And it's because the Friends have responded in America. They've gone out to the four corners of the globe teaching. And look what's happened in Africa. Look what's happened in South America. Look what's happened in the Pacific Islands and things like that. So it should give us a great deal of joy and happiness to see what's happening in this day. Then the Master, one thing, and I'll close with this, was the Master says, if you want to see how fast the cause is growing, compare it with past history. And if you were living in 2,000 years ago, at the time Jesus was speaking around Mount Carmel, you would have had to ask yourself this one question. Would you have been one of the 12 who recognized him, or would you have been one of the thousands who didn't know who he was? So the same situation stands for a Baha'i today. You're hearing about the revelation of Baha'u'llah, and we have to ask ourselves, do we know who the Bab was, and Baha'u'llah was, and Abdul Baha was, and the Shoghi Effendi was? This is the whole question. It's an inner thing. It has to be the heart, consciousness. You know, Baha'u'llah says, knowledge is revealed to us, and learning is acquired, and a donkey can carry a whole library on its back. So one doesn't want to get caught in the position of a donkey.